Good evening. I'm Marissa Levine, Director of Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club, and welcome to Senator Cory Booker, United. We are so excited to be hosting Senator Booker on his book tour tonight in conversation with Lieutenant Governor Newsom at the historic Castro Theater. The video you just watched truly showcases Inforum's mission, connecting influential, inspiring speakers to the most interesting and intelligent people in the Bay Area, you, our audience. We strive to be timely, provocative, engaging, and always provide a space to have great questions asked and answered. We are so happy to have you here tonight. Inforum and the Commonwealth Club's community of members, donors, and volunteers make conversations like tonight's possible. If you'd like to support the Commonwealth Club, please speak to our guest services team on your way out tonight to learn more about the many ways to get involved. As always, there's a slew of great events coming up at the club. The club hosts U.S. Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter on March 1st in conversation with our own CEO, Dr. Gloria Duffy. On March 15th, Inforum welcomes Ellen Malcolm, founder of Emily's List. On March 31st, Shannon Watts from Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America joins us. And on April 13th, we'll be back here in the Castro Theater for Beyond Prisons, a conversation around criminal justice reform with Cut 50's Van Jones and author Shaka Sengor. Get your tickets today at commonwealthclub.org. Now, on your way out tonight, we'd love to have your participation in a quick activity. Inforum has begun a partnership with Minerva, a new global liberal arts college seeking to reimagine higher education. As you exit the lobby tonight, right outside near the box office, you'll see a board displayed listing several key socio-political topics, many that could come up in conversation tonight. Please use the stickers that you were given at check-in to vote for the issue that you find most important in 2016. The winning topic will be the focal point of a student-led discussion taking place in the mezzanine immediately following the event. Take a few seconds to cast your vote before you head home. And now, a few quick announcements about tonight's event. For those of you participating in the book signing following the event, we ask that you please do not bring large bags or packages on stage. Leave them with a friend or at your seat. Senator Booker will only be signing copies of United this evening. If you have not purchased one or picked up your reserved copy, they will be available for pickup or purchase at the book table at front audience right after the event. Also, no selfies or personal cameras will be allowed. We'll be taking photos on our house camera and posting them to social media for you later. Following the event, the book signing line will form in the aisle to far audience left. It is a big crowd tonight, as you can tell, with a sold-out night, so we thank you in advance for your patience. Finally, throughout tonight's show, we encourage you to Instagram and tweet. Our hashtag is always InforumSF, and you can find us on both Instagram and Twitter at InforumSF. Turn the ringers off, though, please. And now, without any further ado, it is my pleasure to introduce to you Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom and Senator Cory Booker.
Hey, everybody. How are you?
God bless you.
Cory Booker. Senator Cory Booker. Mayor Cory Booker. Oh, look at that. He curtsies on demand. Oh, nice to have you all here.
Can you, when I did
my book launch, there were about 20 people. Little jealous, Cory.
You say you're jealous. You're skinnier than me. You have more hair than me.
Yeah.
You're married with kids.
Give me a break.
You want to switch places?
No, he's saying that so I don't ask the tough questions.
No. Look at that hair. Do you guys see the hair?
It's a mess.
I just want to run my hands through
mess.
It.
It's a mess. This is not going as we scripted. All right. My first question. I read your book.
I'm blown away that you actually
read
the book.
A politician that actually reads. I know. But apparently you're a politician that writes.
Can I time out for a second?
No, you cannot.
Please, let me have one moment.
I am controlling this moment. Seriously, you write this thing?
I did write the book.
Because I know politicians. They have ghostwriters. They have all this fancy stuff, and they don't tell.
That's how we roll in politics.
You wrote this.
I wrote every word.
You wrote every word.
Every word of that book.
How long did it take you?
A full year. It was painful. It was one of the hardest things I've ever done. There were very dark, dark days where I had to call phone friends to talk me off of metaphorical ledges, which is really to pull me out of the tub of ice cream. I literally, the last year I was the heaviest I was in my life because my stress My stress response is to eat.
Is he?
Yes, and I practiced.
But you're a vegan now. Right?
I made this. You know, I began to literally. Well, I threatened both my two of my best friends. I threatened Ben and Jerry. Get me a vegan flavor, or I'm a senator now. I will get the CIA after you.
Is that,
yes?
Is that how you
will
guys
be brought to
power?
An undisclosed location?
Uh huh.
Yes.
Is that what's happened to you?
That is
what.
That's
I remember
what,
a humble mayor. Now you're threatening the NSA, and the CIA over ice cream.
Over vegan ice cream. Let's be clear here. Yes.
All right.
I just want to tell how we met. I just want to tell when I had my Gavin moment.
Okay.
Okay. So
I don't remember what. Is this, I mean, all right, go on.
Okay. I just want you, it's good to be back in California. I'm the son of an Angelino. I spent 5 years in the Bay Area at Stanford. And,
oh, yeah.
Yes.
As many Berkeley people here.
No.
The same.
What? I don't understand. As a lieutenant governor, can you not reveal where you actually went to college?
No. I just,
so where's your pride?
I'm on the UC Regents, our public university. I know you are. That's it. I'm just saying. Fancy folk.
So I just want everybody to know that I had my Gavin moment when I watch politicians do things that are not political courage. Is something that is often not seen as much as it should be. And you know, my friend, our friend Michael Bloomberg, who gave me the best political advice of my life. I don't know if he gave it to you, but he said, "Corey, before you become a mayor, become a billionaire." And it was brilliant, brilliant advice. But he often says that the first three priorities for politicians is re-election. And I watched in a moment where you were mayor of this city and you defied the law in order to marry.
I appreciate it.
And this was years and years and years before our current president evolved to the issue before you saw, it was a long time for that. And literally at the end of the presidential election, they blamed you for the loss of Secretary Kerry.
Why are you reminding people that I broke the law? They blame me for Bush.
So I watch you a lot, and the consistency I see and the courageous stances you take. Most recently, I'm sitting down with my two friends again, Ben and Jerry, and I see you come out for legalization of marijuana, which I think in many ways... It's a tough one, but I think that the arc of history is, again, trying to catch up to where you are.
And I appreciate that, and we're going to get to that in our limited time, because you talk a lot in this book about, or you write a lot about, the issues of criminal justice, which I know are near and dear to all of us here. So let's get to the book. You know, what struck me about this, and I mean this, and I really, I'm not just blowing smoke. I wouldn't say anything, so I would manipulate my feelings and just sort of push them aside. What struck me about this book, reason I really liked it, A, it wasn't about Washington, D.C., which a lot of folks may just assume because you're a senator, it's about D.C. It's not a book about who's to blame. You're not sitting around finger-pointing. It's a book about the dialectic between you and a community of people making a big difference, people with formal authority, people mostly with moral authority, people that stood tall day in and day out, that are these unsung heroes that exist from a composite perspective everywhere, all across this country. And you connect it to your own journey in a very personal and pointed, and I would argue passionate way. And so I just want to compliment you, A, on the framing, but I want to talk to you about some of those characters. And I want to start appropriately with your mother. She said something to you when you were relatively young that struck a chord and ignited in your mind dreams, you said. And that was a question she wanted you to ask and answer. And that question was what?
Well, just to give one more framing for it is, so I think a lot of us, when we were in our 20s, which are a very difficult decade, I think because you just have a lot of uncertainty. You don't know what you're going to do, what your job's going to be, where you're going to live, who you're going to marry. And I had this sort of moment of having my life really laid out for me from the time I was in grade school, being a very ambitious guy, always having goals set for myself, a clarity of purpose in school and sports and everything laid out for me until I got to the last possible degree I could do. I was one of those people, as my father would joke, he says, "Boy, you got more degrees in the month of July, but you ain't hot. Get a job, you know." when are you going to actually do something? So I was suddenly second guessing myself, and I felt this calling to do great things and make contributions, but I became very afraid because I didn't know what to do.
And was this your time at law school?
I was in law school, and I couldn't find another degree to do. And my mom was annoying me, as I think mothers are often sort of developed, the mother training school, to either embarrass or annoy their children.
Yeah,
and I was sitting with my mother, and she had been constantly asking me, or at least it seemed like she was constantly asking me, what am I going to do after law school? And I just tried to, one time she confronted me, and I just sort of blew her off. And I said, Mom, I don't really care what I do. I just want to be of service to people and whatever form that takes, and sort of just whined to her. And then she just got very quiet, and then she laid into me with a speech I hadn't heard before. I thought I heard everything she had to say. You start tuning out your parents, I think, at age 6. And she just said this amazing speech to me about leading with the question, you know, are you saying these things out of fear or are you saying these things out of faith? And she set up this sort of dialectic between what is fear and what is faith. And then she led that into a powerful question that sort of changed my thinking, which was, what would you do if you could not fail? And she says, why not live life that way? And if you fail, you will be better off. And she ended up telling me the story from the Bible of the talents, where three men were given monetary amounts from a master who left, came back. Two guys went out in the market, risked it all, had some success. The other guy, thinking he was doing the responsible thing, buried his talent, sat on it. The master came back and praised the two that risked and then rebuked the one that didn't. And this is one of the famous Bible quotes where God says, well done, my good and faithful servant, to the people who went out and risked what they had been given and then rebuked and called the man wicked. And my mom was just saying, you know, you were given blessings like we all are as Americans, and I don't care what your background is. We're given just, in terms of the global comparison, we're given so many gifts. And my mom was just saying, how can you not greet this with fear? How can you greet this with fear and not faith?
So that was an igniting question, and I love it. And you write a lot about your mom, and we'll get to your dad later, who was profoundly influential, and you write so powerfully about him, and we'll get to why in a moment. But there was another character, another person, who profoundly influenced you. Virginia Jones stood tall at 5 feet. Someone that basically adopted you as her own son. Tell us about her.
Well, this is probably one of the more moving things for me to write the book, because you think you know your stories from 20 years ago, and I went back as a reporter to figure this out, and was moved to tears in two interviews because of something said to me. But the beginning is, you have to understand, so my mom gives me this challenge, and I say, okay, well, what would I do if I could not fail? And I often joke I decided to follow the philosophy of this great American prophet that I know they study at Stanford and Berkeley, and the prophet's name is Chris Rock, and he goes, why is it often the most violent street in any city is named after the man that stood for nonviolence? And yeah. I moved on to the south end of Martin Luther King Boulevard, which is a street with incredible glory in Newark, even in the mid-90s, beautiful sections of it, but the south end in the mid-90s was what seemingly chaos. I had worked everywhere from East Harlem to East Palo Alto, but I'd never seen anything like this. In fact, moving in, I had my things stolen from my car as my best friend and I moved myself up, came back to the car, boom, robbery. And I was just intimidated. There were drug dealers across the street, guys who were dealing drugs. I had some clashes with them. And amidst this all, I was told that the woman who runs this area, as now I'm afraid, used to sit crouched in the bathroom of the building I lived in, just watching the drug trade on the street. White friends of mine who would come to visit me, they couldn't even roll down their windows because guys would be pushing drugs in the car. And it was punctuated by violence. And so I have some unfortunate moments with some of the guys on the streets who I think saw me with a lot of suspicion. But it's time I go to Miss Jones, still with this arrogance. I'm this Yale law student, and I go up to her like John Wayne. Hello, little filly. I'm Cory Booker. I'm here. You know, I'm here to save you. And she couldn't be bothered with me and was very gruff and dismissive. And, you know, sitting with her at first, I feel like this is suddenly, it's like a job interview and I'm failing the interview. And of course, my arrogance saying, well, I don't fail interviews. And so she did something with me that sort of blew my mind, which was to take me to the middle of Martin Luther King Boulevard and say, if you want to help me, tell me what you see around you. And I said, what do you mean? And she goes, tell me what you see. And I said, okay, well, I see a crack house, and I described the projects, graffiti. But the more I talked about the neighborhood, the more she seemed just disappointed with what I was saying. And then she finally says, you can't help me. And she starts turning around, walking away from me. And so I run after this woman. I grab her very respectfully. I said, what are you talking about? And she wheels around and blew my mind. She goes, boy, you need to understand something. The world you see outside of you is a reflection of what you have inside of you. And if you're one of these people who only sees problems and darkness and despair, that's all there's ever going to be. But if you're one of those stubborn people who every time you open your eyes, you see possibilities, you see hope, you see love, you see the face of God, then you can be one of those people who helps me. And she walks away, leaving me looking at my feet, thinking to myself, okay, grasshopper, thus ends the lesson. But then I sort of came correct. I went back really humbly and just asked to be in her presence. She slowly let me in, and eventually she started having me do menial tasks like carrying boxes of, you know, sodas for meetings and posting flyers. And eventually months would pass, and I started representing, working with her as her young lawyer, and we took on the slumlord. And long story short, we became partners, or at least I became her protege. She's one of the people that pushed me into politics. But the reason why I say it was a powerful sort of full circle for me to finally be interviewing this woman who was the tenant president of the building since the day they were built in 1969. Her son was murdered in the lobby of those buildings. A former guy served in the military, came home to see his mother, was murdered in the lobby. She didn't leave. She made enough money to live outside of the projects. I moved into the projects, lived there for about 8 years. And these buildings were tough. I mean, elevators would work intermittently, heat and hot water intermittently, roach infestations, mice infestations. It was hard for a young 20-something-year-old and eventually 30-something-year-old, but for the seniors that lived there, the kids that lived there. But this woman, by the force of will, I trace it from before I showed up on the scene to after. But I went to interview her, interview people about her. She passed away. But so now it's time to write the book. And I decided to track down everybody, from especially the guys who dealt drugs in front of the buildings, and found some of them. One guy when he was just coming out of prison, and the guy who ran the street-level drug trade, who it's like New Jack City. I mean, what he did when he finally told me the truth and then cleared it with, you know, I don't know if he talked to his lawyers or what, to really tell me everything. Even at one point he says, you know, the young guy saw you as a threat. They were going to shoot you, Corey, but I intervened, and I looked probably afraid. And I'm like, really? And he goes, no, no, don't worry about it. They were just going to shoot you in the leg. It was just going to be a warning shot. And I was like, all right, man, okay. So I think the moving part to me about this woman and her love is when I went to interview one of her partners, another tenant leader, and told her the story I was writing. She goes, Corey, you've got it all wrong. And I go, what do you mean? And she says, Corey, when Miss Jones met you that first day and you left, she went to us and she said, I met my son. And then the drug dealers that I was, the guys who were dealing drugs that I felt afraid of, and you'll see some of the interactions in the book, I interviewed one guy and he said, Corey, you know, it was Miss Jones that came downstairs and pulled us aside and said, don't mess with him. And the word that she used was, he's family. And so that's this power of this woman to see every child as hers, to be like she said to me in that street when she opened her eyes, she saw other people, regardless of who they were, she saw within them the divinity, the glory of God, and extended the conception of family to me and to others. It was one of the best teachers. I always say I got my BA from Stanford, but really got my PhD in the streets of Newark from professors like her.
So, Miss Jones is the personification of love. Mayor James was not. You ran against an incumbent mayor who allegedly, or quite literally, was tapping your phones, was sending folks out to put parking tickets on your car, or threaten members of your staff. He called you a Republican who took money from the KKK, among many other things that I can't talk about, though you write about.
Yes. But he mentions a lot of other slurs in there of other ethnic groups and the like. And, you know, I joke, you know, I'm a uniter. I mean, if I'm bringing all those people together to support me, there must be, you know, something going on there. But look, the before you even get to the... And by the way, you and I both now probably realize this in your career. When I ran for mayor in 2002 and lost, my advice for people is if you're going to have a spectacular failure in life, have a documentary team there to capture it. You know, because it became an Oscar-nominated. My failure became an Oscar-nominated movie. It lost to another movie you may not have heard of, originally titled March of the Damn Penguins. And I am a vegan, but now I make an exception for penguin meat.
Yeah.
Yes.
Wow.
I taste just like chicken, by the way.
Yeah,
yes.
No,
you think they're cute, but they're flightless rodents.
I'm not checking your Twitter feed tonight. Yeah. This is bad.
But I think that so a lot of this book is sort of my comeuppance. And in the period that I hit this amazing, whatever you think of him, he was one of the more amazing political characters in our country at the time. Yeah. Friends of President... leaders around the country who owed him debt. He was Mr. New Jersey for delivering a Democratic base. Right. And when I ran against him, he had the governor against me and pulled in every favor he had to beat me in 2002. In fact, when I was 18 years old at Stanford, for the first time I ever voted at 18, I voted for Jesse Jackson as my in the primary. Right. And then Jesse Jackson showed up about, what was that? That was 1988, and then 2002 I ran, and Jesse Jackson was showing up to campaign against me.
Yeah,
that's karma. It's just rough. But before that conflict, I was at my wit's end in just my first months as a city council person, facing what was an implacable wall. And I really tell the truth in the book. I was kind of a jerk. You know, I entered the city council with this self-righteous attitude, you all are corrupt. I'm, you know,
you're going after their perks,
going after
going
the council
after saying,
perks.
You know, why are you driving a fancy car? I'm better than you.
Exactly. Yeah. And I really wanted to tell the truth that I felt looking back now, I was just a jerk and I went in there maybe scoring cheap political points that brought attention to me. But when it came to passing legislation that could have helped, I was representing the Central Ward of Newark, one of the poorest census tracts on the East Coast. And I was so poisoning my relationships with fellow council people that I wasn't able to get things done. So
why didn't someone told you got to count to five?
You got a nine-person council. The senior amazing councilman who used to just say, "Boy, you got to learn to count to five. Yeah. You can't get anything done to count to five." And I was setting records for being outvoted 8-1 on the city council and did not know how to count. And so you add that experience to having these chilling moments with the mayor where I began to suspect he was having me followed. Cops were warning me on the side and all of that. And I just began to question why I ever got into politics. Things were going worse and worse and worse. Nothing was getting done. And at the end of my first year, a trigger moment in my life where I was ready to quit politics, where a tenant president who was essential in me getting elected from another set of projects that were in really bad shape, lots of violence at these projects, calls me up and starts saying, "Hey, we had this terrible incident. You got to get the police out here." And I'm like, "I can't get the police to stop ticketing my car. How the heck am I going to get them to come out and help you?" And she starts arguing with me. I start arguing back. And before you know it, we're raising each other's voice. And I hang up the phone. Yeah. And that was the point I say I quit. And I leave. And I go home to Brick Towers where I was living. Just one of those days. And you all had them, is which you just don't want to see anybody. You just want to go home and sulk. Of course, with your two friends, Ben and Jerry. And I get stopped by Miss Jones in front of the building, who was a pain in my neck. She's like, "Don't you walk past me." And I'm like, "Miss Jones, I've had a bad day. You better come over here and give me a hug." And I walked over her and gave her the most insincere hug of my life. And she said, "What's wrong?" And it was almost like she touched a sore. And I remember just unleashing on her and saying, "What's wrong? Why did I get into politics? You can't get anything done." And I started ranting about a year of wasted energy. And then I said to her, and now Elaine Sewell, who she knows, they were both tenant presidents, and I said, "This violent accident, I don't know what to do." And I must have said it 3 or 4 times. "I just don't know what to do about the violence up there." And then she looked at me as if God had just spoke to her. Like, she said, "Oh," and I was like, "What?" And she's like, I know what you should do. And I actually, you know, this is a woman who had shown instances of brilliance before. So I actually stopped and was sort of, she snapped me out of the record I was playing and the pity party. And I said, what should I do? And she goes, I know exactly what you should do. And I was like, okay, what should I do? And she crosses her arm and she goes, yep, I know what you should do. And I was like, Miss Jones, I don't have time to play with you. Tell me what to do. And she goes, well, you should do, and I lean forward, and she leans forward, and she goes, you should do something. And I'm like, what? You should do something. And I'm like, that's it? And she goes, that's it. And I was so angry. As much as I was taught to respect my elders, I wheeled around, stormed away from her, get to my building. Of course, God has dominion over the earth, but the exception is public housing elevators. They're like, they're the devil controls them, I think. And so I hike up these 16 flights because the elevator sensed my mood. And I remember sort of just sitting down there, and I go into it in more detail in the book. But after getting angry at her, angry at the world, I finally had this revelation. And I said, you know what? We often allow our inability to do everything to undermine our determination to do something. And sometimes all we have to do is something, a little something. And in fact, I'm a big believer that we're all here because of the aggregate of small acts of kindness, decency, and love. And that was a lesson harkening back to my father especially. And so I called up my staff with this crazy idea. And I said, you know what, let's get a tent and set it up in these projects, because I want to go live into that tent and just declare to the world that I'm not going to leave. I won't eat food until we figure out some solutions to it. And I had this powerful moment when I showed up at the projects and we were setting up the tent, and I walked over to the tenant president, Elaine Sewell. And this is when I go into the idea a lot in the book about what is grace and how Newark was a place that saw me mess up a lot, and mistakes and stumbles, but the ability for people to extend grace, understanding that grace is not earned, it's given despite ourselves. It's a aspect of love to me that is amazing. And in Newark, I encountered it beautifully, because you would think in a tough inner city that it's a dog-eat-dog world, but I actually saw moments of grace and compassion and empathy and understanding. You are broken, but we all break. You're drug addicted, but we all are susceptible to that. You've had this horrible thing happen to you. And so Elaine, this woman I yelled at and disrespected, as soon as I showed up at that project, she just hugged me, wept in my arms. Before you knew it, we were both crying. And I just said, would you pray with me every morning? I'm not going to leave here till we figure it out. And it ended up being this time where I just sat and witnessed to the region showing up. As soon as we held a press conference, explained what we were doing, you know, people, I mean, the mayor of a suburban town, West Orange, came down to help out. Hundreds of students came out.
You're literally on a 10-day fast.
Yes. But it was almost like, as soon as you sounded that note, hospitals came out to do health screenings, companies came out to job fairs, people were donating computers.
The mayor showed up?
Well, so this is the point I was trying to get to is... It's, there's. Thank you for bringing me back to
no,
the point.
No, I want to connect it.
So you have to understand. So you're taught to. We're taught, in many ways, in politics, to demonize our enemy,
right.
To not see their humanity,
right.
To not see their worth. And this was my adversary, who I had grown in a year so believing he was corrupt or believing he was a quote unquote bad person. But after 10 days of fasting and prayer, when he showed up, I felt no enmity toward him whatsoever, and I suddenly saw him, probably for the first time, as a human being. And this funny thing is about when you write a book, my editor had originally pulled this section out where I talked about this moment where I hugged him,
I
breathed deep.
Yeah, and I remember his smell.
I remember his smell.
I was touched by it, where
I smelled him. And it sounds weird and funny.
Yeah, it does. It reads weird, too.
But okay.
That's just me.
But immediately...
Not with your editor. But anyway, go on.
But
it's actually very... This is really good. Go on. I'm joking. What?
Did I tell you how much I love Gavin's hair? Have I said that already?
There we go. All right. Oh, remember his smell. Yeah, cute. Okay.
But you know, the first time we had a human touch.
Yeah.
And remember, in politics, we're seeing this today, where on a Republican debate, Chris Christie's being castigated for hugging someone, right, for touching another human being. And I had never been this close to the mayor of the city. And when I breathed deep and smelled him, that what got me was, as this older African-American man, is that he smelled like my family. He smelled, yeah, like elder men, yeah, in my family. And part of the embrace, and I think he was so surprised, as this newspaper wrote, which I quote, right, he took his prepared remarks, yeah, put them away, yeah, and then gave a shocking speech to the crowd.
Very complimentary.
Where he almost announced that one day I would be mayor. Yeah. And it turned out to be this incredible moment that didn't lead to long-term success for the projects.
Yeah.
And I say this...
Meaning he walked away, I mean, candidly, he walked away from his commitments.
He made some really powerful promises, yeah, that one of which he never even tried to do, yeah, which was build the park. In the, yeah. And the other ones that he would keep police out there. They stayed out there for a while, yeah, but eventually the cops went away. Problems came back. That was 2002, excuse me, that was 2000. 6 years later, I was the mayor. One of the first things we did is build a park, a preschool, and tried to take on but the point of the story, which I end on, was really just this idea of connectedness. And one of my favorite moments as a human being was the final prayer at these projects, where here in this area where there's a highway going right over a little bit off to the side of the projects, which cut into some of the wealthiest suburbs in America, where people used to come off, buy their drugs, and swoop back on. People have been driving by this property and where human beings live, but we fail to cross these imaginary lines. We fail to see each other. But now on this project, when we're holding hands, 100, 200 people, for a final prayer that went from the first day, 4 or 5 people, to the final day, 100, 200 people, and I hadn't eaten for 10 days. I hold hands with everybody, open my eyes, and I see white people, black people, Latino, Asian. I see young, old. I see believers and non-believers, rabbis, imams, priests, ministers. And I held hands with this circle, and it was the weakest my body had ever been, but it was the strongest I ever felt in my life. And I talk about this, about my final prayer, because everybody was going around and praying, and I heard Hebrew, I heard Arabic, I heard Spanish, English, and as people were talking, I just heard the echoes of our ancestors. You know, there's a powerful song sung during the high holidays by Jewish people where the phrase is Ki beti beit tefillah l'chochomim, which is, may my house be a house of prayer for many nations. There's a powerful a Christian saying that says, whenever 2 or 3 are gathered together in his name, he is in the midst. All these phrases from our ancestry just kept coming back to me, to the point of the 3 Latin words that are the hallmark of this country, E Pluribus Unum. And it was one of these moments where, again, we didn't solve problems, but we were present and we did something. And it was sort of this changing moment for me that made me stick it out in politics. Because if we can replicate, and you don't have to be a politician to do this, and you know this, but if we can somehow understand that we as a country are not meant to be divided from each other like we are, that in fact, I think that the lowest form, I'm almost getting in trouble because I say this, because I dislike this call to tolerance.
Yeah.
That somehow that's the great goal. We should be a tolerant society. Right. But I believe we should move beyond tolerance, that it's a cynical or lazy form of being, that what we should aspire to is love. And love is recognizing that we need each other, that we are dependent upon each other, that we are each other's hope, and that while rugged individualism and self-reliance are wonderful themes in our society, rugged individualism didn't get us to the moon. Rugged individualism didn't map the human genome, didn't build our roads and bridges. And this pursuit of love, which is hard and it's difficult, and you have to be vulnerable, you have to assume that your heart will be broken. But patriotism, which we often use in politics as a sword to demean and to cut other people, I'm better than you, and patriotism. But what patriotism really means to me is love of country, and love of country necessitates, demands a love of your country, men and women.
Right.
And so here is I was on these projects where I felt like we were manifesting not tolerance but love, and it really was a seminal changing moment for my life where I said, you know what, I'm going to stay in politics, but I'm going to change some of my arrogance, some of my ways, And the way I try to operate, not only on the city council, frankly, but even in the eventual contest I would have with the mayor for the mayoralty.
So let's transition from love, which you may be the only politician I've heard talk about love. God bless. Let's introduce your father. Let's talk about 2004. Your 35th birthday.
Oh. So I get emotional because this was one of the moments I'm still was still working through. So writing this was hard. And so you have to understand my father death can end a life, but it can't end a love. And he's still very present with me. And so my father is just extraordinary, charismatic, a funny guy. My mom is like a gospel, strict gospel hymnal. My dad is like jazz, irreverent, all over the place. And so you get in a certain age where your father becomes still your dad, but also your friend as well. Yeah. And the funny thing about my father and I is we had these role reversals. Like, I've never had a drink in my life. My dad does not like to be without a drink in his life. Yeah. You know, so he would hang out with my friends as peers. I would be the designated driver.
Yeah, you're right about that.
And When we would go out, my dad would literally come to Newark and like, okay, son, you stay home. I'm going out to the club, and he would hang out. I mean, he was just like, he was in some ways a better politician than I was around the city, and just fell in love with this. Remember, my father brought my brother and I up in a world different than him. He grew up poor. He would heckle me if he heard me saying that he was poor. Don't tell those people I was poor, boy. I was Poe, P-O. I couldn't afford the other two letters. Tell the truth now. He grew up in Jim Crow, North Carolina, and it was this conspiracy of love. He saw the best of humanity break a cycle of poverty going, now I know, back into slavery, getting him to college when it wasn't his vision to go there, had no models for that. In college, again, he witnessed African-American activists and white activists. He would tell me black and white, gay and straight people, strangers coming into the South to dislodge this nation from Jim Crow. And he landed in Washington, D.C., and again, it was a conspiracy of love. He was a qualified African-American, but I don't care what your background is in this country, if you're Irish, if you're a woman, if you're black, there's sometime corporate America probably didn't want you, and yet he saw people come together, help him get his first job. And even when we were moving into Harrington Park, this all-white town, they wouldn't show, oh, Harrington Park. It's like this town is 2 square miles, and we have Harrington Park represented here. Wow. But they in this 1969, they wouldn't show black families homes in towns like that. Yeah. And so it was this group of activists, this conspiracy of love, these people who, white and black, who set up an elaborate sting operation for my parents to move into the town. They were told the house was sold. The white couple found the house still for sale. They put a bid on it. The day of the closing, my dad shows up with a lawyer to confront the real estate agent, who then punches my dad's lawyer, sigs a dog on my dad. A melee breaks out in the real estate agent's office. And for those of you who are gasping, trust me, every time my dad would tell the story, the dog would get bigger.
Bigger.
It went from Toto to Cujo. A pack of wolves were in that office, son. So we move into this town, and my dad has achieved for himself his Horatio Alger story, right, from poverty to this incredible neighborhood. But he was always worried about his kids. And my father would remark to me as I walked around my house with teenage swagger, going on a football scholarship to Stanford, my dad would say, boy, don't you dare walk around this house like you hit a triple because you were born on third base. And so he now raised me to do what I was doing. I'm now in Newark, joined with heroes in this community, fighting for kids like him. And he surprises me for a birthday visit in 2004. Yeah. And we're walking in a neighborhood, and gunshots ring out. And I sprint towards where the shooting is. An off-duty cop was behind me, pulls his gun, sprints up the hill after me. There's a young man who's sort of on a stairwell. The boy had been shot. Me and some other people sort of lay him on the grass. And it's nothing like for, I hope most of us have not seen a human being die of a gunshot wound, but it was the most horrific thing I had ever seen. Trying to stop the blood coming from his chest, foamy blood starting pouring from his mouth. It just seemed like forever until the ambulance got there, shoves me out of the way, rips open his chest. But I had been feeling for pulses. I knew he was dead, but he's loaded in the ambulance, taken to the ER. And so now I'm standing there. I walk down the hill. Cops are asking me questions. The police director comes up to me, but I had now waved my dad off and told him to go home. And so this is probably one of the most painful interactions I had with my dad was I had lost an election in 2002. This was the long gulf until I would get a chance to run for mayor again. Mm-hmm. And now it's 2004, and I'm probably, this is one of those times where my heart was so broken that just blackness entered. And I barely even remember that walk back to Brick Towers where I was living. But by the time I got upstairs and my dad opened the door and sees his son with another boy's blood on him, the look on his face was one I had never seen before, but I had no interest in it. And he probably wanted to hug me or say something, but I pushed past him to go into the bathroom, and I got in the bathroom and started trying to clean the blood off my hands and just was trembling and, you know, just started crying in that sink and, you know, took off the clothes that I was wearing in a heap, stood in the shower, and I don't know what this was about, but I turned it on as hot as I could possibly do until it practically burned my skin, and just was crying in the bathroom and just feeling angry at this world, angry at my country, feeling like I had witnessed now too many boys, particularly in boxes, too much murder and violence. And everybody, I can name names like JonBenet Ramsey or Natalie Holloway, but could anybody name one kid in my city who had been murdered? Do any of them make the headlines? And so my dad said something around to me this time, which I think you're getting at, that was, I think, his despair, but it really was like a punch in the gut, where he said to me he worried that a child born poor to a single mother in a segregated environment would be better off, like he was, would be better off born in 1936 than being born today. And me, who I'm up as you are, actually obsessed with data, and I just started, in my mind, it triggered all these thoughts that, you know, unlike my dad's time, the leading cause of death for young black men is murder. Unlike my dad's time, one out of three black boys born will go to prison. And all the data facing young African-American men. And this is actually coming towards the end of this chapter where I did not want this to be a book that, you know, the title's United, but to give anybody the illusion that this is an easy road to connection, to love, to courageous empathy, that it is actually really hard. But at this nadir of my journey towards journey through Newark, it was Miss Jones when I woke up the next morning and came downstairs and walked through the lobby in this, I felt like I was drowning 25 feet underwater, but something eerie when I walked through that lobby and the echoes of Mrs. Jones's son's murder in that lobby sort of jarred me a little bit because I didn't know Wazin Miller, the young boy that died. And then I get into the courtyard and there is nobody in the courtyard except for Miss Jones, whose back is to me. And I see her and I just stop. And the funk and the fog feels like it's being shaken. And then she, this small elderly woman, turns around, sees me, knows exactly what happened. And like she did before, in the garden, before Garden Spires, she did the same thing. She opened her arms up, and I wanted nothing more than to be in her arms. And I walked up to her, and I'm 6'3", and she's 5 feet. And she just hugs me like a little boy, and I disappear in her arms. And again, I just start crying. And she just rubs my back, and she says two words over and over. And I'm telling you right now, from that moment till now, even in the Senate, when I get frustrated, when I get despondent, when I get angry, when I feel like I hit a dead end, I respond with these two words spoken by a woman who who demonstrated to them to me before she showed them to me, words that have nothing to do with religion, but have to do with the quest of this country, the call of this nation. And she just rubbed my back and said the two words over and over again. She said, stay faithful, stay faithful, stay faithful.
Yeah. Your father passed away just a few days before.
Yeah, six days before I got elected to office. And for him, you know, it really hurt because my father was very conscious that I was running to be the fourth elected African American in the Senate's history. That for my father, he was almost tickled. My parents have this saying, behind every successful child is an astonished parent. And so he's like, this is the guy that I couldn't get to mow the damn lawn. And, you know, he's going to be a senator. You know, yes, yes. Hercules, Hercules. So the thought of having my father there on that day was really crushed upon his death. And so my mom, who's a brilliant, as I said, a sort of a Bible soldier, you know, she goes with me, and she and my staffers make the decision that, okay, before you go to Harry Reid and then the vice president to be sworn in, we're going to take you to see someone very special in Congress. And she takes me to the office of John Lewis. And John Lewis is like, the guy is a living legend, but what gets you about him is like, he is the most humble human being on the world. And like, you know, he had set up this food for us. This was before I had become a vegan. So there's grits and eggs and, you know, all the things that have shortened African Americans' lifespans. He won't let you get up and get food. He's serving you. But meanwhile, you're looking at his wall and you're seeing these iconic images from the civil rights movement. And then you look a little closer and he's in those iconic imagery, you know, on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, marching with Martin Luther King. Yeah. And it was almost as if my mom was screaming at me, you came this far by this courageous faithfulness of soldiers who elevated you. And then as we walked to Harry Reid, almost as if my mom was like, and I joke in the book about, like, did any other senator in the history, you know, did LBJ, when he swore his oath, did he have his mother in his ear? I'm like saying the kind of thing. So my mom was just like, it's like as if she's never going to see me again. You know, she's like telling me all these things, like, urgently. And all of them started like, remember, you know, the title doesn't make the man has got to make the title, you know, and it's like, you know, all the way in. So I kind of go through this stuff, but. And then it was like you, and it was on a very auspicious day that I got sworn in. Began my Senate career on Halloween, you know. And then I swear my oath, and then senators come over and shake your hand. And I probably had one of the more meaningful handshakes I had in the Senate with a guy who just days earlier, because I ran a special election and then it swooped into the Senate and was sworn in, unlike the normal cycle where you have time to wait. So this guy had been in, you know, days, if not weeks before, slamming me. He was the only senator that came into campaign against me.
Yeah.
And then I'm on the floor and I see him walking over to me and I'm like, yeah, come over here. And then not because he had campaigned against me, but because I had heard him speaking about an issue that's close to your heart. Right. And my heart, because he had been talking about criminal justice reform, and it was Rand Paul, and I grabbed his hand, he said, I hear you've been talking about me, and I said, I have, and it was our first policy conversation was about drug policy reform, and for me, it was this urgency, because when I was a mayor, in the days before I became a senator, I was still dealing with horrible violent crime, still dealing with a nation that is so... It's like a cancer on the soul of our country that we have a criminal justice system in the land of the free, where we only have 5% of the nation's, of the globe's population, but we have one out of every four imprisoned people on the planet Earth is here in America. And it's very different. You know, I watched drugs in the town I grew up in, drugs use on Stanford's campus, ecstasy, marijuana, a lot of more serious drugs. But the drug war wasn't being fought on college campuses. People weren't being stopped and frisked on the way home from a frat party. Dorms were not being, it's being fought in inner cities. And our jails are being full of mentally ill, of poor people, of addicted people, of people of color. So much so there's no difference in this country between Latinos, blacks, and whites for using drugs. We're all at the same rate of drug usage. There's a little bit higher rate for young white men for selling drugs. But if you're black, you're going to get arrested for drug use or sales about 3.7 times more likely. And when you do get arrested for the same crime, if you're white, then if you're black. If you're black, you'll get about a 20% longer sentence. And so I had watched this cancer eat at the soul of our country, draining our national treasury, where while we were disinvesting in public universities, in high-speed rail, in, we were disinvesting in our infrastructure. By the way, other countries' percentage of GDP were doing better than we were in the 90s. But the one area we were dominating the globe in infrastructure investment was building a new prison in the United States about every 12 days. Yep. And so it became, for me, witnessing the carnage in inner cities. Because when people come out, by the way, we're this weird country where we say innocent until proven guilty. But in most states in America, just having an arrest record, you could be legally discriminated against. Even if you've been proven innocent, you can be legally discriminated against in the workplace, in a housing, and the like. But even if you have been arrested for a nonviolent drug offense for doing things the last two presidents admitted to doing, you can't get a job, you can't get food stamps, can't get Amen. A Pell Grant, can't get business licenses. And so we wonder why then we put people on a course to do more crime, 75% recidivism rates. So we keep spending as a population as opposed to the far cheaper way of doing this, which are things that you've been talking about for years. So it was a wonderful, and all this was packed into the first minutes of my, these conversations in the first minutes, or if not hours and days of my Senate career, going from being on the street, being the 21st American actually in American history.
Yeah, direct mayor.
To go direct from being a senator to be, from being a mayor to being a senator.
So we, so in 3 minutes, I'm going to turn it over to all of you. We've got 15 minutes, and anyone who wants to speak, be prepared. We're going to bring a mic up, and I just encourage folks to ask a question, not make a statement and say, do you agree with me, but ask a question. And we'll try to move through as many as possible. But I want to just quickly pick up a little bit on, because it is fascinating. I mean, you made the point about Rand Paul, but it's also interesting. People may not know this. Some, I imagine, do. The Koch brothers.
Yeah.
Grover Norquist.
Yep.
Newt Gingrich.
Yep.
Senator Mike Lee.
Yes.
Many other Republicans and libertarians agree with you and have been working with you.
Yes.
On criminal justice reform, drug policy reform, and reforming our prison system.
It's whatever your bent, if you're Christian evangelical, this violates the biblical precepts in so many ways.
Yeah.
If you are libertarian, this is government stealing the liberty of people unnecessarily in ways that have never before really been seen in the modern world. If you are fiscal conservative, as I said before, government bureaucracy has exploded. Since 1980, the federal prison population has gone up 800%. Yep. The overall prison population, 500%. Yep. And you all know this in California and have done some courageous things in this state and ending three strikes. And in fact, most states who are doing things like that, lowering their prison population, surprise, surprise, crime is going down as well. So this is something that whatever your political background, you should be in favor of. And so a lot of the legislation that I've been a part of in the big scrum, we're in this really critical point, and people who are interested in watching the Senate, this is going to probably be the month where this is either going to go to the floor in the Senate and get voted on, or will die like many bills. And I've had a certain way of doing things in the Senate where I've really worked across the aisle, bipartisan. Most of my bills are in partnership with the Republicans, finding common ground. But this is the kind of thing that is, there's such an urgency that should this begin to fail, I'm going to be one of the loudest, angriest senators that have ever been witnessed, I think.
I like to hear that. So we've moved from love to anger.
They're consistent. They're consistent.
Now it's your turn. First question.
right, and can we bring up the house lights? Because I would really like to see the people who are here.
All right. Okay. Someone's going to run around with a mic and grab you.
Right over here, stage left.
All right.
Yes.
Great job, by the way.
Thank you.
I think one of the
unless you're talking to Gavin, no, great job. Could you bring up the house lights a little more? Because I can't really make out this guy to see if he's got sort of the Gavin hair or the Booker hair.
Christ.
More of the Gavin hair.
Okay. Yeah. Can we have the next question? Equal time for bald people, please.
So I think one of the areas that people don't understand a lot about is the privatization of prisons. And I know they talk a lot about that in the public, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more and educate everybody a little bit about
that. Well, Gavin was teasing me in the back. I've been blessed to have Gavin as a friend for many years now, and I judge the closeness of my friends. I actually say this in the book, by how much they tease me. So he was saying to me in the back, like, Booker, are you going to give TED Talks for every response to a question, or are we going to get a lot of questions in? So
We did all right. I'm impressed.
So, very short, I am against private prisons. I think when you put a profit incentive into taking away the liberty of people. Now, most of these private prisons, most Americans don't realize this, are sort of detention centers for immigrants, for people who have come into our country. And we actually do things in those places that really do violate, to me, what the values are of this country and detain people that are no flight risk, who often have American family members. So this whole thing, I think, just needs to be exposed to the public, and I think that we should get private prisons, to make the private prisons in our country a thing of the past.
Excellent. Next question.
We have a question here in the center, towards the back, from Lizzie.
From Lindsay or Lizzie?
Lizzie.
Lizzie.
Hi.
I was wondering if you could elaborate on why you are endorsing Hillary Clinton, which I am as well, so I am, like, very thrilled. Especially because, you know, some of the criticism from others within the Democratic Party more on the left is that she has a shameful record from the early 90s of her involvement with, you know, creating this problem of privatized prisons and mass incarceration for the black population. And I was wondering if you could talk about how you've obviously thought through that in a way that you're proud to support her.
I appreciate the question, even though, again, Gavin and I were joking backstage about how this is a primary like I've never seen before, where, you know, every time he and I are both big on social media, but every time I post a, you know, pro-Hillary thing, I get the Bernie backlash. I'm feeling the burn, basically. like I've never seen before. And I'm accused of things that I've just I'm sort of surprised in it. So let me just be very blunt about two things. So first, second, I'll tell you why I'm endorsing Hillary Clinton. But just please understand. So for a guy who for 2 years now in the Senate has, I'm proud of a lot of things I've accomplished in the Senate, from major infrastructure accomplishments for the busiest river crossing in America is the Hudson River, and its infrastructure is failing. Made a lot of progress on that. I can go on the things I'm proud of, but this has been, if anybody knows me in the Senate, this has been one of the issues I've been fighting about since I got there. And, you know, everybody, there's so many people with dirty hands of the past. The Congressional Black Caucus supported the crime bill, the 1994 crime bill. Bernie Sanders voted for the 1994 crime bill. And so to make it about Hillary Clinton versus Bernie Sanders, you know, there's an urgency everywhere. Like, this issue is not new. I mean, Senator Sanders in his state has barely 1% black people in his state. And yet his prison population, the prison population of Vermont, is over 10% black. And so these issues of racial disparities, these issues of grievous waste of human potential and waste of taxpayer dollars have been going on for a long time in the Senate. And my issue and urgency is not to point fingers of blame, but take responsibility for joining with others to solve it. And if that is Rand Paul and Mike Lee or Bernie Sanders and the Congressional Black Caucus, who's united to change this, that I'm going to join with them. But to use this right now as an issue, I think that the history that I have of dealing with this, when I was an Obama supporter in 08, and the Clintons still were reaching out to me when I was mayor about this issue and how to unravel the problems, that Hillary Clinton, before this was being talked about by the Sanders campaign, she made her very first policy speech. I've seen the polls on this. This ain't the top issue on people's minds, but her very first policy speech was about criminal justice reform, and her office consulted my office on the policy. So going down to why I support Hillary Clinton, it's really two reasons. One, when I sat down with her before this election heated up, and this is one of those weird elections where I know most of the people well who are running for president. What's that?
No, I didn't bring up Ted Cruz, but go on.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Look, I went to Oxford with Bobby Jindal. I sat on a board with Jeb Bush. I passed legislation with Ted Cruz. I've got legislation with Marco Rubio. Most of the people running, Chris Christie and I can write a dissertation on my disagreements with the man, but we worked very closely, very closely together. So I know the field very well, including the two Democratic candidates. And I'm going to tell you unequivocally, when you have a policy conversation with Hillary Clinton, she knows the subject matter, no matter what the passions are of mine. And so understand this. I come at this from a guy who sleeps, goes home. My house is in an urban core in a poor neighborhood. And I can go through the nuance, so can Gavin, the nuances of urban housing policy, of homeless issues. And when I talk to her about that, she knows these issues. She knows what's worked. She knows what isn't working. She has ideas about new plans and policy. And then on top of that all, she talks to me very specifically about strategies to get things done in a divided Congress, because we ain't going to win the House back in 2016. And then the other thing that she has, which is a very important quantity for me, and I think Gavin and I probably learned this having run cities, the powerfully, and I don't know if you would agree with me, but one of the most difficult things I had to learn was hiring. Like, how do you hire people and what do you look for when you hire? And so there's a quality that I found and defined as grit. Hmm. And so think of a person in American politics that has had more difficulties, hardships from the time that she was First Lady of Arkansas and what they said about her and did to her as she was trying to push public education. Think about her being First Lady, how dare she stand up and think about policy and say ridiculous things like, oh my gosh, we should have universal health care. And then the attacks she got from the insurance company, she took a failure there, but yet then rises yet again to higher levels of service. I was in the New York area and saw what they tried to do to her to stop her from being United States Senator. I saw what happened, we all did, when she ran for president and lost. Every time she gets hit, every time she gets pushed back, she keeps coming back. Every loss, every stumble, she rises again to a higher level of service. And you judge a person most when people aren't watching. And so now I know a lot about her when she was Secretary of State and what she was doing around this globe to deal with issues that we don't talk about enough, whether it was the genital mutilation of women and what she did to fight for that, standing up in China and fighting for women's rights, going to places like the African sub-Saharan continent and talking about economic empowerment of women. And so
Sue, you are running for vice president. Is that what it is? I knew something was up. This book tour, there's something going on, Booker. I'm on to you. It's pretty clear, isn't it?
Okay, so
come on,
Gavin. I'm gonna take that as a gauntlet you just throw down, because you know you're not gonna be a lieutenant governor forever. I could start talking about.
All right, don't get me started. Next question. Who else do we have?
Hoo ha! All right.
We have our next question from the left, from Lakeisha.
Well, you keep saying like the left and the center and the right. I immediately go to political spectrum. Exactly. You know, we have from the far left wing of
the political spectrum, the radical socialist from California, Alicia. Go ahead, Alicia.
Lakeisha.
Lakeisha, excuse me.
Yes, and first of all, I was going to say thank you for this conversation. I've been really enjoying it. And what part that struck me is the part where you're telling the story of the fast and how you were able to unite people of various backgrounds. And so I wanted to get your insight on how you were able to do that, because I think that all the divides that you were noting that you kind of bridged speak to touching people, striking a chord. And then kind of related to that, you talked about the issue of, you know, having to realize that you were, you know, being, I guess, you know, having to realize that you had been arrogant with respect to the other council members. And I wanted to see, did you ever have a way of reconciling your past behavior and bridging, you know, more alliances after?
Well, I'm hoping that my former fellow council people are reading this book and seeing the apologies therein. And I'm sure some of them are like, yeah, you were a jerk. Look, if anything, when you read this book, it's a lot of stories about my comeuppances and me struggling to learn lessons and live up to the examples of some of the, as Gavin said, some of the titans and heroes from my life. And I don't have all the answers. I do know this, that a lot of times we in America think that this democracy is a spectator sport and that we can sit on the sidelines and just root for our team, red or blue, or root for the people that are so-called in the arena. But that's just a mistake. And I've gotten caught up in my life in that, I call it the state of sedentary agitation, where I'm so upset about what's going on in the world, but don't realize that I'm the one that has to get up and do something about it. And so all I can say is if you want more, if you want more love in this world, then you've got to be more loving. If you want more leadership in this world, then you've got to lead. And if you want more unity in this world, then what are you doing to be a uniter? Because in our own circles, there are lines that we don't cross, barriers we don't reach above. And so one of the best things, one of the more beautiful, I talk about coincidences in this book a lot, and one of the beautiful coincidences, again, when I was doing research for this book, those were the moments that sort of like made my hair stand on end, was in this chapter that somebody's laughing about hair stand on end. It's a rough crowd. Come to Jersey. I'm going to show you how we treat you there. but this is a moment as an example about what we underestimate our power. In fact, Alice Walker says the most common way we give up our power is not realizing we have it in the first place. And so the example I'll give of this is that the lawyers who helped my family move into Harrington Park, I tracked them down. I wanted to find out all the stories that I knew in my family. I wanted to find the people that were there so I can get them, make sure I get them right. And so I call up a lawyer, Arthur Lessman, in his 80s. Hi, sir, I'm Corey, but I know who you are. I said, okay, did you know that you were my family was one of the families that you took the case file? And I know all that. And well, could you tell me a bit, why would you, this white lawyer in the late 1960s, be doing all this to help black families move into Bergen County, New Jersey? And he says, well, it was a Monday. And I go, Monday, you know the day of the week? And he's like, yes, it was a Monday. I came to work and I told Leo, my partner, that we needed to pack up the firm and go to Alabama. And Leo laughed at me because we both knew we couldn't afford to close our offices one day, not to mention to get up and go to Alabama. And I'm still confused why Alabama. He goes, well, it was the Monday after Bloody Sunday when John Lewis and these other activists were on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And it was stunning to me that he was so touched by that, that he'd made a decision that I have to do the best I can with what I have, where I am, and do small acts of kindness, decency, and love. And I don't know if anybody on that bridge had any conception that just by standing there and being a part of that tragic but yet stirring moment, that they unleashed a set of events that would change the course of my family's lifetime. There's no action, no matter how small, when it's done in the cause of love, grace, unity, and other of the spiritual assets that are a part of humanity. There's no small action that is wasted, and it has more of an impact than many of us imagine, but we don't do those small things. So my only request to you is, I don't have all the answers. I'm still trying to figure it out in Washington right now, but But I do know this, that great change in American history has never come from Washington. It's come to Washington by people like us in this room.
So we have time just for one more question.
Come on, man, push the envelope and do two questions.
I will ask the last question. We have one more time.
We have a question in the final row, in the center, stage right.
Moderates in the center.
Senator Booker.
Hold on, where are you?
I am right here.
Wave your hand in the air.
I'm here.
All right.
Okay. I have on black, maybe you can't see me.
I see, sister, I see you clearly. Clearly.
But if you
want to come a little closer, give me a hug.
Oh, of course. Absolutely.
Okay.
My name is Sandra, and I want to thank you for being so fluid about faith and the way it has influenced you. Many say of you, if this country is to elect another African-American president, it will be Cory Booker. My question is, what does Cory Booker say about ascendancy to president of these United States?
I was wondering why she walked in with you.
Oh, she did.
Now I get it.
She's my cousin, man.
I got it.
Okay, so
it's strange. Yeah.
So somebody tweets at me the other. I love Twitter, and somebody tweets at me, "Will you be the VP like Gavin was being a smart guy?" And I said, "Yes, next year I will be Hillary's VP vegan practitioner." So Gavin and I both know this. Again, I can really speak for Gavin's heart. I've had a lot of heart-to-hearts with him over the years. And I'm a big believer that when politicians often get into a position, especially the Senate, and you know this, if you start thinking about what is that next office, it often undermines your integrity and authenticity about where you are right now. Life really is. Life should be, especially in our professional career, life should be about purpose, not position. And there are times when we may have views, like I do, that may make it harder to get to the presidency, if that was an ambition. And I will never want to shirk on those views now. As one of my friends told me, there ain't no way a vegetarian will ever get elected to the White House. So I made it even more challenging and became a vegan. But I will say this, what you said about faith, and I think this is really important. We live in a nation, I think, where sometimes faith and that idea of patriotism, as I talked about before, is often used to put people down and not to elevate. And I'm a big believer that we should talk about authentically about who we are in a political space. I never want to hide from people my spiritualism, but I do want to be somebody that believes that before someone. And I say this all the time, wait, before you tell me about your religion, show it to me and how you treat other people. And so I thank you for your remarks about faith, but I just really believe that what we need in this country is a set of civic values that we herald. More than people who are preaching about their religious. And for us to be at a point in America where we are allowing fear to so change us, that I talked to earlier today somebody who was French, and to watch the French be attacked in horrific ways, and we were all moved by that. And then them come back and say, you know what, we're going to take 30,000 refugees. We're not going to let ourselves be chained. And I joked that after hearing what some of the commentary was by other politicians, I joked that that the French were trying to out-America us. Because our response for some people was to shut down this country to allowing Muslims to come into this country. And so I think that all of our life we have one thing to do over and over again, one choice to make, either to live our truth or diminish it, to tell the world about ourselves authentically without words, or to shrink from that, to take responsibility for what's going on or accept things as they are. And for those people who aren't satisfied with the status quo, and want to accept responsibility for change, before we talk about what other people are doing or criticize other folks, I just hope that before we criticize, we first ask ourselves, what more could I be doing myself to make change? Because I said this to a couple that came up to me about their daughter, and I'll end here, but I think it's true for us, period, not just for in the way that James Baldwin says it. But James Baldwin is my favorite author, and I think a few of the best pages of literature for me was The End of the Fire Next Time, where he writes a very painful book. I love that Baldwin does not shrink from talking about the wretchedness of reality, but then he always comes back to hope, which I write about, a long passage about what I think hope is, which Ms. Jones showed me this. It's a response to despair. It doesn't exist in the abstract. It's not letting despair have the last word. And Baldwin writes at the end of this book, I know what I'm asking you is impossible, but in today's day and age, the impossible is the least we can demand. And one is, after all, emboldened by the spectacle of human history in general, and Negro history in particular, for it testifies to nothing less than the perpetual achievement of the impossible. And so Baldwin says, and this is where the quote I wanted to end on, which I said to a couple about their daughter earlier tonight, Baldwin says that, and I don't think of this just in terms of children and elders, but Baldwin says that children are never good at listening to their elders, but they never fail to imitate them. And what I believe about each other, and I take when Gavin, who was mayor before me, was so courageous. I entered the mayorality. What year were you elected mayor?
03.
03. What year did that?
04.
04. And yeah. I was elected 06. Yep. I say this very purposefully. When I saw the courage of Gavin Newsom, I walked into office. One of the first things I did, Gavin, was to raise the pride flag. And I got hate calls, and not anonymous hate calls. I got people calling me up telling me who they were and what they thought about voting for me and how they made a mistake. And then I declared that I would not perform marriages.
No, you were extraordinary.
But I'm telling you, your courage helped to ignite my courage. And my mom got upset to me when I announced I wouldn't marry people. My mom's like, just marry one person, please. But we don't.
They finally got that. Yes, it took a little while.
It's one of those
slow rolling jokes.
Yeah. So I just have to say that what we do is the most powerful thing in the world. And I'll say this. I'll admit the last thing about how small things matters. When I was in New York, you know, you and I both, the ugly side of politics is campaign finance, and we should reform it.
Thank you.
San Francisco does it really well. So I don't even remember. I was in New York, but I think I was in New York, you know, getting ready for a campaign for city. I'm trudging through horrible, slushy snow. There's like these curb cuts. You don't know anything about this out here in California, do you? horrible, slushy curb cuts where it's like an ocean of slush. And I'm walking through this like humble, trudging along, trying to avoid like the one of the two suits I own from getting like slush. And then I see an elderly African-American woman, not of means, carrying one of these wicker baskets with the wheels on the bottom, and she's approaching the Pacific Ocean of slush. And my mama raised me right. So now I'm thinking to myself, I got to go help this person cross the slush ocean. And just when I'm about to go there, I see this guy cut in front of me who I had stereotypes about at that point. Right. Looked like he was straight from a rich Wall Street bank, dressed in a suit that probably was worth more than my wardrobe, and shoes that were worth more than the car I was driving. And he cuts in front of me as if I wasn't there, goes through the slush in his fine shoes, picks up this woman's cart, puts it on, then walks her a circuitous route around. And I just stopped there and witnessed this, blowing away some of my preconceived notions, but it made me so happy.
Yeah.
The rest of the day I went on lifted. And that's the power we all have. Before we criticize the world, we got to check ourselves and begin to do as Gandhi says, to be the change we wish to see.
Yeah.
Hear, hear. All right. So this brings us to the close. But we have a... Look. So Corey brought a lot of luggage, and he doesn't want to bring it back. So he's got books that he would love to sign, and they're all right here. And right when we're done, we hope every single one of you lines up, patiently waits for a personalized autograph.
I will sign a book, and you're going to wait around and hug everybody who gets a book.
But first, now you got this. If you did your homework, you would know in Inform, we always ask one final question. It's always the same question.
But is it really always the same question?
Always the same question. Even if I made that up, just bear with me. But one thing is certain, it's only a 60-second response. But you're in politics, but so I'm schooled.
I can't filibuster this.
No, just 60 seconds, not okay. 90, not, you know, 60 seconds. 60. It's a simple question, and it's not very open-ended, so it should be a simple one to answer.
Now, this is not the question about how the Commonwealth Club helped me when I was a kid. Okay, I'm shutting up.
No, which it did.
It did. No, this is a true story.
They actually want you to say that.
But that's a true story. When I was, so I was a Stanford student graduating.
You have 30 seconds for this.
For 30 seconds. I used to order the cassette tapes. You all remember what those were? I used to order the Commonwealth Club's cassette tapes. One of them was, I had heard Jack Kemp speak at the Commonwealth Club and was so sort of moved by him being a Republican, but he was saying things I agreed with. I bought his tapes, would used to listen to him time and time again. I was preparing for his interview for the Rhodes. I found myself quoting him. Later, when I was running for mayor, my first D.C. fundraiser was thrown by Jack Kemp and Bill Bradley joined together to do my first D.C. fundraiser. I feel like the Commonwealth Club planted those seeds. I want to thank our hosts.
That's good. So what is your one... Here it is. What is your one 60-second... idea to change the world.
My one 60-second idea.
To change the world. It's simple. That's an easy one.
This is not
60
easy.
60-second, yeah, that's no, come not on.
A, dude, if you were really my friend, which I thought you were, I thought you were my friend until this moment.
That's easy.
You could have like, they could have told you could have whispered
idea.
In my ear, this is coming
seconds.
Up.
60 seconds. Change the world.
I think our...
Buy like my
everything,
book.
Everything,
buy my book. No,
it's all in the book. No. I mean, I'm going from everything from clean, renewable energy.
I know. This is unfair.
But right now, look, I think that a lot of times bad systems produce bad results.
Yep.
And I think we have this amazing democracy with so much to be proud of. But there's parts of it I'd like to change. And so if I could change two things about democracy that I think would produce a better result, it is the way we draw our district lines.
Here, here.
The way we finance campaigns in this country.
Couldn't agree more. Ladies and gentlemen, Senator Cory Booker.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody.